G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. It's great to have your company again today. Well, polls show the US election race is not over after all. For weeks, ever since audio emerged of Donald Trump's extremely lewd remarks about women, the conventional wisdom has pointed to a Hillary Clinton landslide. Today, though, the race is a lot tighter than anyone had the right to expect a week or so ago. We'll soon chat with John Judas in Washington on why America may experience its own Brexit moment in coming days. Plus, this week marks the 60th anniversary of the Suez Crisis. It was the single most disastrous folly of British foreign policy in the post-war era, at least until Iraq.
This is the news from the ABC, read by Mervyn Eady. Here are the headlines. The Suez Canal Zone is full of tension, but there has been no report of any Anglo-French landings. Israeli troops are in action, and there has been continued air activity. The General Assembly of the United Nations has adopted, by 64 votes to 5, a United States resolution calling for a ceasefire. Australia has voted with Britain and France against the resolution.
We'll revisit the Suez Crisis from 1956. Stay with us for my segment with British writer Geoffrey Wheatcroft. Well, he's back. Donald Trump is narrowing the gap in the US presidential election race. And many of you are probably still shaking your heads. How could such a rude, crude, lewd buffoon, someone who's long been an object of derision and contempt, how could he resonate with so many ordinary Americans? Why? My next guest says it's a mistake to say Trump's appeal is just due to racism and sexism. Nor is it fair to think this frustration and popular anger against the established order are confined to the United States. Just look across Europe, where you have various populist, nativist movements. They're on the rise. John B. Judas is author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed America and European Politics. He's also been one of Washington's leading journalists for about four decades, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him back to Between the Lines. G'day, John.
Hi, and it's always good to be talking to Australia, a place I really like.
We often talk about Trump as if this is an isolated incident, but people forget Bernie Sanders, the 74-year-old socialist who gave Hillary Clinton a real run for her money. John, what do Trump and Sanders tell us about the underbelly of America's political system in 2016?
Well, let me go back even farther than that. I had to persuade my publisher to write about the United States because in May of 2015, didn't seem to be anything happening. The Tea Party was dying out. Occupy Wall Street had pretty much petered out. And, you know, everything seemed to be happening in Europe. And then in August of that year, when we were on vacation in New Hampshire, we went to see this guy, Trump. And he was talking at a high school, and there was a line like a movie premiere that was 200 yards of people stretched around this high school. And I listened to him, and you heard some of the same themes that he still says, but there were other things that really surprised me. The attack on corporations, he singled out Ford for moving their plants to Mexico and leaving American workers in the lurch. He talked about corporations moving their headquarters overseas in order to avoid paying American taxes. He talked about trade deals with China and Mexico that had resulted in big trade deficits. Now, these are issues, you know, you might hear them among left-wing labor Democrats. It was a real echo of Ross Perot and Pat Buchanan from the early 1990s. Again, candidates who then were much more on the outs politically. But here was a guy, Trump, who has ended up being the nominee of the Republican Party, evoking these same kind of themes. And, you know, what it suggested to me is that the discontent in America with a kind of, you could say it's not really a conservative. The word is used a lot as neoliberal worldview, the idea that corporations can move anywhere they want in the world, people can live and move to any other country they want, is under attack. It's being questioned. And here it was, a Republican, not a Democrat, who was asking these questions.
So Trump, just to clarify, Donald Trump, the Republican presidential candidate, is repudiating neoliberalism, free market economics, and globalization.
Yeah, and again, you would find some of the same themes, not the same views on immigration, though. Bernie Sanders was pressured by, again, this kind of neoliberals in the Democratic Party to favor open borders. Anybody can come to the country they want. Now, that's a policy that helps a lot of the big companies. It helps hotels. It helps construction companies that want cheap labor. But a lot of times it screws low-income workers, unskilled and semi-skilled workers who are already here, who find themselves suddenly having to compete with people who are willing to work for a lot less. So Sanders also said he wasn't for open borders. But in terms of corporations and what we call runaway shops, companies leaving the country, those were themes that he also articulated. And, you know, after he got the nomination, Trump started to talk about what Sanders used to call a rigged economy. Yeah. We have a rigged economy. So, again, I think that Trump, when you hear him speak, he wants to get on the news, he wants attention, and he always throw in some kind of crazy zinger that then gets reported, and often they are something nativist, racist, whatever ist word you want to use about them, insulting, demeaning to women, Mexicans are rapists, but a lot of the rest of his speech is these kind of economic nationalist populist themes that, you know, you would not hear from the leaders of the Democratic or the Republican.
Yeah, because a lot of your critics, though, especially on the left, would say you're putting lipstick on a pig, that Trump supporters aren't simply the white working class who have been displaced by globalization and free trade deals and modern technology. They're really just racists and xenophobes and sexists and bigots and fascists. How would you respond to that?
Well, may I make a long reply to it?
Go for your life, John.
Okay, I'll just tell a story. In 2008, when Obama and Hillary Clinton were vying for the nomination, I decided to do an article on whether Obama could ever get elected president. And I looked at all these surveys that we have, the General Social Survey, there's a national election study that's made after elections, and they have all these kind of racial cues in them. Would you want a black person to have the house next to you? All these kinds of questions that are supposed to indicate racial resentment. So I thought that I had proved conclusively that Obama could not win the presidency. Of course, he won. Now, let me add one other thing about this experience I had in 2008. I took one of these tests. They have these tests for implicit racism, where you punch a key, where they show you a kind of Rorschach test things. And it turned out I was a sort of a racist, too. I didn't score very well on these. And I grew up in Chicago in a climate where people were afraid the blacks were going to come from the south side, the whites. And so I have in my unconscious a lot of these same kind of fears, but it hasn't determined my voting. And I think that if you look at Americans that way, I mean, look, Trump is winning Ohio now. Obama won it twice in 2008 and 2012. Now, did those people suddenly turn into racists who were supporting Trump? I don't think so. I think that Americans are a much more complicated people. And, you know, the question you have to ask is why suddenly we have in both the parties, in the Democrats and the Republicans, this kind of critique of the economy surfacing. And I think it has a lot to do with the Great Recession and its aftermath. You can add to that the fact that there are a lot of racial resentments. There's a lot of feelings about the people speaking Spanish. Why do we have these people and things like that? But again, I think that there's this important economic dimension that is constantly lost and ignored, particularly by Washington journalists who live in a kind of bubble of their own.
I'm Tom Switzer. If you've just joined us, you're on Between the Lines. My guest is John Judas. He's author of the new book, The Populist Explosion: How the Great Recession Transformed America and European Politics. John, you mentioned the impact of the global financial crisis in 07, 08, 09. Let me run a quote by you. It's Francis Fukuyama in Foreign Affairs recently. I like this quote, and I run this by a lot of our guests. Quote, "The real story of this election is that after several decades, American democracy is finally responding to the rise of inequality and economic stagnation experienced by most of the population." John Judas.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. And especially the economic stagnation. You know, from, let's say, 1996 to 2000, we had this big boom in the country, a soaring stock market, and you had a lot of internet billionaires, and you had a tremendous increase in the kind of inequality between the 1% and the 99%, but you didn't have a lot of populist economic nationalist sentiment. Perot and Buchanan pretty much shot their wad in 1996. They were finished really by the spring of that year when the economy started to pick up. So if you have a buoyant economy, people can put up with a lot of inequality. When you don't have that, when wages start to stagnate, when people lose hope that their kids are going to do better than they are, when kids are saddled with these enormous student debts, then the questions of economic inequality rise to the surface. And I think that's what he's referring to.
Yeah, but John, on that note, though, to be sure, Europe has a pretty elaborate welfare state. You don't have the kind of inequality in Europe that you're witnessing in the United States, and yet we're still seeing the emergence of these Trump-like populist movements. How so?
Look, there are different kinds of populism. And, you know, this again gets complicated. In Britain, incidentally, you do have inequality. The issue is appearing in a very similar kind of way. Not so much in other countries. Now, look, you could distinguish between a left-wing and a right-wing variety of populism. All populist movements that in the United States and Western Europe, we're not talking about Latin America or Eastern Europe here, have this distinguishing characteristic of pitting the people against an elite. For the left-wing movements, Bernie Sanders, Podemos in Spain, Syriza in Greece, it's the bottom and the middle against the top. It totally looks upwards. It's a vertical movement in that sense. It's only got two terms to it, people, elite. For a lot of the right-wing movements, there's another element. They also attack, Trump attacks Ford Motor Company and Carrier Air Conditioning, but he also accuses the establishment of coddling Mexicans who come across the border, Muslims who want to get into the country. There's a third element. There's an other that enters in. And in a lot of the European countries in the northern part, the themes are more on the right than the left. And there's this third element. And especially the question about immigration and asylum seekers is very much on the forefront in, let's say, Denmark, Holland, Germany now, France, Norway, Sweden, Austria. In the southern tier of Europe, in Spain, in Italy, in Greece, countries that just got decimated by the Great Recession, where unemployment among kids of 18 to 34-year-olds was like 50%. And I think in Spain, it's still around 40%.
Wow.
You had a pulling together of the bottom and the middle. You didn't have this idea that the middle was as threatened as the bottom of the society. In the United States, middle class is still doing okay, so it's more a question of we're going to have to pay taxes for the unemployed or for the uninsured. In Spain, in Italy, in Greece, everybody was thrown into the same pot the way they were in the United States in the 1930s. So you get more of a pure left-wing populism in those kinds of situations.
Final question. It's on the minds of a lot of people around the world, including Australia. Will America experience a Brexit moment in the next week?
Well, I don't think so. But, you know, this FBI report, it's saying that they're going to look into Hillary Clinton's finances, certainly hasn't helped her campaign. There's still in American elections a lot of people who stay on the fence till the last moment. What I would look for is if Hillary Clinton starts campaigning in Pennsylvania, a state that Donald Trump has to win to become viable.
And by the way, the Democrats have won Pennsylvania every presidential election since 1992.
Yes, it's a big state. And it looks like she's going to win it pretty easily. But if you start hearing that she's visiting Pennsylvania, then the election's going to be very, very close.
John, it's been a pleasure having you on RN today.
My pleasure as well, Tom.
Via Skype, that was John Judas, author of The Populist Explosion, How the Great Recession Transformed American and European Politics.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Here's a thought experiment. Two leading Western powers target the dictator of an Arab nation. They grossly exaggerate the threat the Middle East state poses. The dictator himself is regularly compared to Adolf Hitler. The two Western powers set out to embark on regime change. The question of UN approval assumes importance. So too does the notion of a preemptive strike. The execution of the plan is strikingly inept. Popular support for the military intervention falls dramatically. And the episode culminates in the humiliation of the two Western powers. Their credibility and prestige are badly damaged. And oh, by the way, Australia, at the insistence of our Conservative Prime Minister, we play a prominent role in the crisis. Iraq 2003? No, I'm referring to the Suez Crisis of 1956. And to discuss this week's 60th anniversary is Geoffrey Wheatcroft. He's a writer based in Bath, England, and author of several books, including Yo Blair and The Controversy of Zion. Welcome back to the show, Geoffrey.
Well, it's very good to be back with you, Tom.
Analogies are tricky and hardly perfect, but does a comparison between Suez and Iraq hold true to you?
Well, yes. I mean, as we approached the Iraq War, I was a little boy at the time of Suez, but as we approached the Iraq War, comparisons seemed to me stronger and stronger the whole time. I mean, you've outlined it already, but there is this resemblance between two occasions when an Arab dictator had angered Western powers, and the Western powers wanted to get rid of him. We know that in the case in 1956, the British government wanted not merely to intervene in Suez. They were fretful about Colonel Nasser seizing the Suez Canal. We know that the government actually wanted to get rid of Nasser from the minutes of the cabinet committees that summer of 1956. Now, for political reasons, they could not avow that they were simply trying to overthrow Nasser, because there was rising Arab nationalism. There were more and more countries becoming independent. And because the Americans at least struck attitudes in opposing colonialism and neo-colonialism, albeit somewhat hypocritically. And so the British and French had to concoct a conspiracy, a ruse. If you remember, what happened was that they colluded with the Israelis. The French thought that Nasser was fomenting the rebellion in Algeria at the time, although in fact the rebellion didn't need any fomenting, it was a domestic insurgency. And the Israelis simply regarded Nasser as their greatest mortal enemy. So what was going to happen, this was done at Sèvres, just outside Paris, with representatives of the three countries meeting in the greatest possible secrecy. The Israelis would attack Egypt, and then the French and British would turn up, ostensibly in what was called a police action, to separate the warring powers, though in fact to get rid of Nasser. Now, it all went grotesquely wrong from the beginning, and the Americans were appalled by this. President Eisenhower said, "Anthony Eden, Anthony, have you gone out of your mind?" Because there was this difficulty, which explains the need for the conspiracy. Conor Cruz O'Brien, the Irish writer, once put it rather well when he said that the British and French were attempting the delicate feat of destroying the most popular of Arab rulers without forfeiting Arab support. Now, if you come forward 47 years, you find something very similar. This time there was another conspiracy. The Bush administration wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein. The purpose of the war, as we know now, was regime change for the sake of regime change, although that was against the doctrines of the United Nations and in theory against the principles held by all of the powers concerned. So they had to find another reason, an ulterior reason for attacking Iraq, and they came up with, as we all know, the weapons of mass destruction, which turned out, unfortunately, not to exist.
So let's just recap here. So the Western powers, France and Britain, they didn't attack Egypt openly, but they hatched this secret plot with the Israelis. They wanted to get rid of Nasser. And so Israel would attack Egypt, and then you had the French and the British forces. They'd intervene on the pretext of separating the combatants. That's right.
That's right.
People might be confused about this because London presumably just assumed that they had the support of Washington.
Well, they did, or the Americans would at least put up with it as a fait accompli. It was an enormous miscalculation. I mean, among other things, it made Winston Churchill's so-called special relationship look absolutely absurd. I mean, this special relationship has never existed. It completely misunderstands the nature of international politics.
Well, different nations have different interests. Now,
precisely.
Eden and the French then went on to the Suez adventure because Nasser had kicked out the British army. He seized the Suez Canal. But why did Eisenhower oppose the mission?
For very good reasons. I mean, Eisenhower was engaged in a great real struggle, a Cold War with Soviet Russia, and the Middle East was a crucible for that conflict. And Eisenhower was trying at the time to make friends with the independent Arab nations who would see if they could be enlisted as allies on the American side. And he thought this was extremely damaging to the interests of the West, as indeed it was. The British general in charge of the abortive operation said afterwards, in 1956, General Keithley, he said, "One thing we must now realize is that world opinion is a crucial factor in all diplomatic and military enterprises from now on." And Anthony Eden comes out of Suez far and away better than Anthony Blair comes out of Iraq. First of all, the conspiracy, the pretext was so absurd. It was grotesque in the case of Suez, and yet everybody saw through it very quickly, and Eden was being denounced within days by newspapers like The Observer in London. That was the famous sentence in The Observer Leader in 1956. "We had not believed that our government was capable of such crookedness and such folly," which I thought that a newspaper should have republished in 2003.
The Suez crisis, though, brought down Eden. Iraq didn't really bring down Blair, though.
It certainly did not bring down Blair, and if we lived in honest political culture, it would have brought down Blair as well.
My guest is Geoffrey Wheatcroft from Bath, England, and we're reflecting on the 60th anniversary of the Suez crisis. Geoffrey, why did the so-called special relationship then between Britain and America survive Suez in 1956 when clearly many Brits, Conservative and Labour, they thought that Washington had betrayed them?
Well, Washington had betrayed them in a sense, although Eden had asked to be betrayed. The special relationship was a myth at all times. Max Hastings, the military historian and journalist, wrote only weeks ago that Winston Churchill concocted the idea of the special relationship for reasons of political expediency and was then the first British Prime Minister to discover it to be a myth. Because the Americans don't support the British come what may and have never done. Why would they? I mean, it's an absurd notion. In 1974, when Harold Wilson had returned to the Prime Ministership and
he replaced Edward Heath,
and in the dramatic summer in August 1974, Richard Nixon resigned as president. So it was a piece by Louis Herron, famous English journalist writing for The Times, no longer with us. And he, as it were, looking ahead at Wilson's first meetings with Gerald Ford, the new president, the piece was headlined, "Mr. Wilson must realize that the special relationship is dead." That was 42 years ago. Unfortunately, the special relationship in a way came back to life in Iraq, except that in Iraq, the special relationship found its apotheosis and met its nemesis because it was a complete and utter disaster.
Well, people forget this, but after the Argentinian invasion of the Falklands, I mean, American assistance for its British ally, that was far from open-handed or even instant. And then, of course,
it certainly wasn't instant. Indeed, Jean Kirkpatrick was the American ambassador at the United Nations at the time under Reagan and a particularly fanatical neoconservative. And she had dinner at the Argentine embassy the day that they invaded the Falklands. And Sir Nicholas Henderson, a very, very nice guy, a most excellent man who's no longer with us, Mrs. Thatcher had very shrewdly taken him out of retirement from the diplomatic service and sent him back to Washington to be ambassador. And he said that what Gene Kirkpatrick would have done would have been as though he had taken tea with the Iranians on the day they seized the American embassy in Tehran. And I mean, it was completely absurd. And the concept is absurd.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, that's not to mention that Thatcher was incensed when Reagan invaded Grenada, a former British colony, right?
Of course. Mrs. Thatcher was much less committed to
it. So how do you account for the fact that this special relationship has endured, even though time and again Britain and America have not seen eye to eye since Suez?
It hasn't endured. It has merely endured as a catchphrase, as what Americans call boilerplate. It's just something that has to be recited whenever a British Prime Minister meets an American president. They have to make these nice noises about the special relationship. Again and again and again, it has been shown not to exist in practice. Let me just finish my three reasons, by the way. The first was, as I said, about why Anthony Eden comes out of Suez better than Anthony Blair out of Iraq. The second reason is that, although it did a lot of damage to the British in 1956, the fences were soon mended, and in fact it didn't take as long to get over the debacle at Suez, whereas the catastrophe in Iraq will have consequences with us for generations to come.
Mm-hmm.
And the final reason, by the way, is that for me as an Englishman, I wouldn't expect anyone else to see this, is that at a pinch, even though the Suez adventure was misconceived beforehand and miscarried in the event, at a pinch it could have been defended in terms of the British national interest, and our participation in the Iraq War could not be. It was a simple prostitution of the British national interest for his own purposes by Tony Blair, and has been immensely damaging to this country's interests. Quite obviously.
Well, back to Suez, Jeffrey. In his retirement, President Eisenhower, he did admit that the biggest foreign policy mistake of his presidency had not been supporting Anthony Eden over the Suez crisis. What was that about?
Well, when politicians say that sort of thing later, you don't know whether they mean it or not. I mean, maybe Eisenhower did come to think that, but he was wrong. If he thought he was right at the time and wrong later.
Yeah, sure. Well, let me run a counter-argument by you. This is the British historian Andrew Roberts. He wrote this in The Spectator about 5 years ago, quote, "If Arab nationalism had been strangled in its cradle in 1956 by the vigorous action that Anthony Eden prescribed, then the oil price hikes of the early 70s and all the economic woes that flowed from them would never have happened. I doubt there would have been a 9/11 either." Jeffrey Wycroft.
Andrew Roberts's political opinions, though he's written some good history books, his political opinions are, to put it politely, so eccentric and weird, and he's so far on the cranky right that he's very difficult to reason with.
Sometimes he's a British version of a neocon.
Andrew Roberts, 20 years ago, at the height of the conflicts in the Balkans, said that the answer was to use tactical nuclear weapons against Serbia. Perhaps he thinks that we should have used tactical nuclear weapons against the Arab countries in the 1950s, because that is the only way that Arab nationalism could have been suppressed. If people like that are honest, they say that we should go back to full-blooded empire, which nowadays would require enormous armies to conquer and pacify the Arab and Muslim countries.
Jeffrey, it's been a pleasure talking to you again. Thanks so much for being on Between the Lines.
Well, really good to talk to you, Tom.
That was Jeffrey Wycroft, author of several award-winning books, including The Strange Death of Tory England. Finally, remember our recommended list? Sylvia Rowley, she's writing in the New York Times, on Australia's lesson for a thirsty California. Now, she reviews our own drought from 1997 to 2010. That's our worst in recorded history. And she proposes how a government can persuade millions of people to nearly halve their water use. It's a good piece. Now, for more on all this, consult our recommended list this week. Just go to abc.net.au/rn and follow the prompts. And while you're there, you can hear the program again or send us a comment. So that's all for this week's edition of Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.